Thank you very much, James. And likewise, thanks to all of those at London Insight who have made this day possible. And thanks once again also to King Alfred School for allowing us this wonderful site in London to be able to practice. And thank you to you for being here. Now, this is a meditation day, but the title of the presentation may not give that impression towards a secular Buddhism. I can promise you that the two are connected, but what that means is that this afternoon's reflection might be somewhat more about wider issues than the actual nuts and bolts of meditation practice. First of all, before we begin, could anyone here who has not done a day like this before raise your hand? Okay. Now, those who have raised your hands, are there some who have never done any meditation at all of any kind? Okay. Good. So what I'm going to start with is just a few suggestions as to how we might proceed in terms of the meditation practice. London Insight belongs to a tradition, if we can call it that, which goes under the heading of Vipassana, which means insight meditation. But most of us probably are familiar with the idea of the practice of mindfulness, and that's going to be very much the core of what we'll be cultivating today. Now, James already alluded to silence. Silence is very much a supportive condition or environment in which to cultivate mindfulness. As we're all aware, we live in a world that is full of noise, that our lives are besieged with audio inputs, either through the media or through conversations or through posters or whatever it might be. And today, we're going to take a break from that. And as a way of making that break very explicit, we're just not going to talk. And we're going to spend our time in this space of the school where other people, by and large, won't be talking either. And so it allows us to really have a breathing space, really, not only from the external chatter of the public environment, but also the internal chatter of our own minds. Because just because you don't speak to one another doesn't mean that you stop speaking to yourself. And in fact, what this so-called silence makes very clear is how noisy our minds are. So the meditation practice is in many ways coming to terms with the noise of our own minds. This constant monologue, this ongoing commentator, this inner voice that just won't shut up, and that by and large is running the story called me. So one of the big problems that you'll encounter, particularly when you start trying to meditate, is how difficult it is not to get caught up in your own inner narrative, not to get carried away by it. Of course, at times we are conscious of the fact that we are fantasizing about going on holiday to Portugal next week, or we're worried about a difficult job interview we're going to have on Tuesday. But what happens so easily is that we lose the consciousness of that holiday or that job interview, and the narrative somehow takes us away. It propels us into its own domain in such a way that we actually lose consciousness. And one of the strange things about beginning to practice meditation is that we become aware of how little aware we are. Because although I'll be giving a very simple instruction, basic instruction, just to sit still and be aware of your breath. Although that's a very simple thing to do, it's not easy. In fact, you might find it rather alarmingly difficult, because the habitual narratives and stories and plans and worries and so forth, that inner voice will just take over and run you along with its own discourse, to the point that you actually forget that you're sitting here and that you're breathing and that you can hear the sounds around, that you're aware of the play of light and colour in the room, that you've got certain physical and mental, emotional sensations in your body. It's all forgotten. And so as soon as you come to and notice that, then you bring your attention back to, in this case, the breath. So that I would suggest as the focus we take. For those of you who have got an established practice in this or in any other tradition, please use the meditation periods to pursue that. But for those who are beginning, the instructions are very simple. Just find a comfortable posture. So if you're sitting on a chair or on the floor, try to keep your back upright. Unless you have back problems, not leaning back against the chair, and also being aware of the tendency to slump, particularly as you start feeling a bit drowsy during the meditation. So just try to keep your back upright and just to let the breath come and go in its own time. In other words, to just open yourself and relax into the primary rhythm of your own body, your own being, really, the breath. So don't picture the breath, don't have some idea of what it's like, but feel it as a rhythm of sensations, physical sensations. Noticing what in some ways might seem rather banal, the sensation of the breath as it is drawn through the nostrils, down through the windpipe into the lungs, and then exhale. But just stay with those very ordinary sensations. And you'll notice that these sensations are, of course, rhythmic. There's a pattern to them, the in-breath, the out-breath. You feel in the body a certain way. And these are very palpable sensations. If you haven't done much meditation before, it might feel like a rather odd thing to be doing. And you might find that, in fact, these sensations, you can't quite notice them, even, sometimes. But once you get aware of how the breath is known to us through the physical sensations of the body, we can use those physical sensations as a basis for grounding our attention. That's the purpose of it. There's nothing inherently spiritual or noble about the sensation of the breath in the nostrils. But it does serve as, or it can serve, as a basis to which we can return each time we wander off or get distracted or succumb to drowsiness. You just go back to that rhythm of sensations in the body. And by sustaining attention on that rhythm, then, over time, the mind will start to quieten down. and that chatter might become a little bit less, or even if it persists, you find that you don't have to buy into it. You can turn the chatter of the mind into an object of awareness as well. The purpose of this training in attention is not to become the world's most proficient breath watcher, but to recognize that the breath is just, as it were, a sort of starting point, an anchor, on the basis of which we can then slowly begin to apply the same quality of attention to the other sensations in our body, to our inner feelings, to our states of mind, and finally, to whatever it is that is impinging on our experience, on our senses at any given time. So we start with a relatively narrow focus, the breath, but, and this becomes more evident when we do walking meditation, the aim is to cultivate an attention that we can apply to all situations in life. It's about refining a particular perspective, not just on ourselves, but on the world in which we are inextricably a part. Now, that's the nuts and bolts of it. I'd just like to make a few more comments about the what we call this perspective, or the quality of attention that in the Buddhist tradition we seek to cultivate. And I'm going to look at a term that we find quite a lot in the earliest teachings of the Buddha, and that is a term, dukkha parinyaha in Pali, which means dukkha is usually translated as suffering, but actually it's really a kind of a generic term for life, birth, sickness, aging, death. And it's somewhat misleading to think of it as only referring to the painful parts of life. Buddhism has unfortunately stuck with this word dukkha and has, I think, offered some great insights into it, but there's still a problem today that it sounds almost unavoidably negative. So it's almost perhaps better not to translate this word dukkha. Dukkha is a way of talking about our primary experience as human beings. Human, in other words, creatures who have been born, who are aging, who are subject to breakdown, and who at some point will most certainly die. In other words, that is our existential condition. And as we all know, there are times of great sorrow and grief and pain and anguish, but there are just as many moments of joy, of happiness, of fulfillment, of enthusiasm, maybe even of ecstasy and bliss. All of that falls under the heading of the human condition, the existential condition. So I would rather not use this word dukkha, almost, and just think of this practice as a practice that has to do with our primary situation as human beings. That basic question that life presents itself as. And what is this experience right now? We're trying to, in a sense, get in touch with, in some ways, experiences we may have had as children, a kind of an innocent wonder at the fact that there's anything at all, a kind of almost primitive delight in being here, but of course also at the same time a willingness to be honest and truthful with ourselves. That this is not a perfect situation. That our time is running out. That with each breath we take, we're taking one breath less. So in many ways, I think, we have to try to find a kind of an embracing awareness. And that's where the notion of parinya comes in. Dukkha parinya means literally to fully know dukkha. You might translate it as to embrace dukkha. In other words, to say yes to this situation we are in, being embodied persons in this world. Not, as it were, saying, well, I can accept certain things I like, but I find it very difficult to accept the fact that my mother is getting very old, or that I have this chronic headache, or whatever. In this practice of awareness, in this practice of attention, we start by trying to get back to the very ground of our awareness. And so although we're focusing on the breath, in the larger scale of things, we're actually focusing on our life. Breath being, of course, a wonderful image of life. The first breath a child draws at birth, and the last breath that is exhaled at death. So we are touching something very primary in our experience. And the Buddha's suggestion is that we know that fully. Now what does he mean, to know that fully? Well, he describes that in one text at least, where he says to know something fully means to know it without attachment, without aversion, and without confusion. Without attachment, without aversion, and without confusion. Now this is perhaps sounds a bit odd, because in our normal way of speaking, at least in our modern culture, to know something fully we'd think of as, you know, acquiring some kind of complete knowledge about it. A good zoologist fully knows the particular area of her specialization. But here, the kind of fully knowing does not have to do with any kind of quantitative acquisition of information about something. But it has to do with knowing our experience from a particular perspective. A perspective that is not driven by likes and dislikes. It's not driven by the push-pull dynamic of attraction and aversion. That's the key point in a way. And if we put that positively, it suggests that how this attention is developed is through cultivating also equanimity, an equal-mindedness. An ability to be able to say, yes, that's very enjoyable, that's very pleasant, that's very agreeable, without then running into immediate attempts to acquire it and to fix it and to hold it and to get it again, but simply to be able to say, yes, that's very enjoyable, that's very, very pleasant. And likewise with things that are painful, or uncomfortable, we'll notice as we start to cultivate attention that very often provokes, and this is presumably biological, an aversion, a dislike. I don't want that. Get rid of that. So the Buddha's idea of embracing or fully knowing dukkha means to be able to notice also that tendency in the mind to be pulled towards things we like and to be repelled by what we don't like. And I suppose one of the claims behind this practice is that it is actually possible not to get caught up in that push-pull dynamic, but to cultivate a quality of attention in which we find a kind of inner equilibrium and balance. As a practice, we'll notice that we keep getting caught up in the habitual, maybe even instinctive, patterns of our being. And so at the beginning, this is why meditation is difficult, even though it's simple, is because we're working with something that's very deeply seated within us. And as I've mentioned, probably the result of our evolution and our biology. But the third quality the Buddha speaks of is to fully know something without confusion. The word in Pali is moha, sometimes translated as delusion. I think confusion is slightly better. But frankly, I think that it also includes what we might call a kind of a sluggishness or lethargy of mind, a dullness of mind. We might even think of it in terms of boredom. In other words, if an experience is not exciting us in some way, either by attracting us or repelling us, then we just sort of settle for being bored. And it may well happen that in your sitting in meditation, you might experience moments of boredom. You might find yourself wondering, when is he going to ring that bell? Maybe he forgot. Maybe the watch at the top of the front here has gone wrong. I may be stuck here for the rest of eternity. Strangely, boredom is not something much discussed in Buddhism, even though you might have thought that millions of monks and nuns and lay people meditating for millions of hours over 2,500 years, boredom might have become an issue. But I do think boredom is very possibly suggested by this idea of moha, usually called delusion. At least experientially, that seems to fit closer to how I actually feel when I meditate. I'm either attracted or excited about something, I'm fed up with something, or if neither of those are going on, I'm slightly bored. Now, boredom is perhaps the most difficult one to work through. And I think the practice does in terms of boredom is just by sustaining attention on the breath, the body, whatever happens in this moment, over time we start to realize that this is utterly fascinating and absorbing and deeply curious that this is all going on. We seem to have lost the capacity for this kind of simple wonder at life itself. And so this, I feel, is an important element of this practice. It's not just about finding an equanimity between attraction and aversion, and just being kind of cool and chilled and aware, but also, in a sense, as an antidote to boredom, it's about stilling and focusing the attention, looking more carefully, more openly at what's going on, and discovering something almost mystical. That's not a word I'm particularly keen on, but to experience something about the sheer mystery of life itself. to be surprised by the fact that you're here, the fact that this is going on. So that's all I'm going to say. We're going to now sit for 30 minutes, and then we'll have a walking session, and before that I'll say something about the walking meditation. And then we'll come back here and do another sit, and then before lunch we'll have an opportunity for discussion. If you'd like to stand up, especially those of you sitting at the front, just to stretch your legs for a minute or so, then we can begin. Thank you.